Vice Marshal Johnson, real one. Can you tell me, first of all, there, Vice Marshal, where you were born?
Can I tell you? Sorry.
Whereabouts you were born?
Barrow-on-Soar, Leicestershire.
Which year was that?
1915.
Can you tell me about your family and educational background?
Am I on this? Were we on? Yes. My father was a police constable at that time in the Leicestershire Constabulary. And we lived at Barrow-on-Soar, a little village, until I was 6 or 7 years old. And then we moved to Castle Donnington, another little village in Leicestershire, and eventually to Loughborough, and eventually to Melton Mowbray in Leicestershire, where he retired as an inspector of the Leicestershire Constabulary, and I would then be about 17. So all my young life was spent in Leicestershire.
What kind of an education did you have?
I went to the grammar school at Loughborough and part-time to the University College at Nottingham.
How did you come to join the RAF?
I joined the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve. Weekend flying and evening flying and evening studies in navigation and airmanship and that sort of thing.
Which year was that?
That was 1938.
And what reason did you have for joining that?
Well, I thought the reason we had for joining that, before that I was in the Leicestershire Yeomanry. I'm sorry, I made a mistake there. I didn't get into the Volunteer Reserve till 1939. I was turned down in 1938 because they were up to capacity. So I joined the Leicestershire Yeomanry and then transferred to the Volunteer Reserve the following year when they expanded. And the reason I joined was because all young people of my age in the late 30s knew that war was inevitable.
But you didn't have to join the RAF Volunteer Reserve.
No, but I say we would rather join something than learn to fly and become proficient than stay as civilians and be called up into something like fire bloody watching or something we knew nothing about, really.
What was your personal reaction when you heard Chamberlain announce that we were at war with Germany?
Well, we just thought it had been a long wait and it was now time to settle the issue. Because, I say, we'd regard it as inevitable. And if you remember, well, you don't, but 1938 was the crisis at Munich and so on. And we were just waiting for the declaration of war. We knew that it would come sooner or later.
What were you actually doing when war was declared?
I was on my way to Cambridge.
Can you remember the reason?
Yes, we were called up the day war was declared, which was a Sunday, as I remember. And several thousand of us sent to live in the various colleges at Cambridge, whilst the undergraduates were down, somewhere to put us. And from Cambridge, we were farmed out to various flying units and as they became available over the next few months.
Which unit did you go to?
To fly, do you mean? To learn to fly? I went to Marshall's just outside Cambridge. Marshall's Flying School at Cambridge.
What was your instruction like there?
Oh, it was very good. I'd already done some flying in the Volunteer Reserve, but we all there'd been such a long break, we didn't start flying again until 1940, that we had started right from scratch, which was probably a good thing. And the instruction was excellent, and after 50 or 60 hours on Tiger Moths, we went to Sealand, near Chester, where we flew 40 or 50 hours on Miles Masters, and thence to a little operational training unit at Harden, where we flew 10 hours or 12 hours on Spitfires, and thence to our squadrons. Almost a year from being called up.
Can you tell me what you thought of the Spitfire as a plane to fly?
You mean originally, when I flew it originally? Yes. Well, it was much faster and more powerful than anything that I'd flown so far. The only thing I'd flown was the Miles Master, which didn't really approach it. This was something that seemed quite extraordinary. It tore along the grass at enormous speed, and by the time you'd got your undercarriage up and closed the hood and trimmed the thing up, you were well over the Welsh hills, and it was, so it seemed to me, and out of sight of the airfield. And the speed and at which everything occurred just seemed quite fantastic at the time. Eventually you got used to it.
Did the plane have any vices, in your opinion?
No.
Did you ever fly any other plane which you preferred, or did you have a special sentiment for the Spitfire?
I flew Hurricanes and Mustangs and various other planes during the war years, but I think the Spitfire was by far the most pleasant aircraft to... I think some Frenchman said you had a love affair with the Spitfire.
Do you think it deserves the enormous reputation it has nowadays?
Yes, I think it does, yes. A very pleasant airplane, thoroughbred, yes. The only drawback was it didn't have the range.
Were there any problems that you had in learning to fly, or did it all come easily to you?
I wouldn't say it came easily. I found the night flying, I suppose we were rushed into it... rather quickly at Sealand. We were taken, I remember, to a little satellite airfield and sent off in the dead of the night with just a small flare path. And I had difficulty in with no radio aids and that sort of thing, and finding it once or twice and getting back. I found night flying very difficult, and I think we should have been given more time. But then time wasn't on our side.
Can you be more specific about the difficulties of night flying?
Well, A, you had the weather to contend with, and B, there were no radio aids. I mean, if you got lost, you were lost. You couldn't call up the tower and say, could you give me a homing, and that sort of thing, which you could in 1941 and 42. So once you were away from your airfield on a dark night, with everything blacked out, it was a very testing time for young people, with very few hours on airplanes.
Were there, at that time, any sad accidents with colleagues in learning how to night fly?
Yes, they were. There were chaps who were killed and so on and so forth. A small percentage, not a lot. That's a very small percentage.
Had you expected to be quickly into combat with the Luftwaffe at that time?
I joined my squadron in August of 1940, which was almost a year from when, not quite, almost, it was late August, and we'd been called up in the previous September. So it had taken almost a year to get through the training program. That's what I'd expect, yes.
Which was your first squadron?
It was a squadron, it was an auxiliary squadron called 616, the South Yorkshire Squadron.
Can you tell me about its personnel and equipment and leadership?
It was stationed at Kenley when I was sent to join it, and it was led very badly, as a result of which, on the day I joined, six or seven people were shot down and killed. Or six were killed and several wounded and so on and so forth. They were bounced very badly through very bad leadership, really. And the squadron was taken out of the front line that day I joined. They were taken out because they'd been decimated and sent to Duxford near in Cambridgeshire. Sent to Coldershaw, I'm sorry, in Norfolk, sent to Coldershaw.
What should have been done that wasn't done?
The CO at the time, I suppose, and I don't know who it was because I wasn't there, wasn't fit to lead the squadron.
So was morale low when you joined the squadron?
Yes.
How did it show itself?
It showed itself by... I was one of several newcomers, and the veterans kept themselves to themselves, were very aloof, and didn't want to discuss their experiences and so on and so forth. Yes, looking back, their morale was low. and they shut themselves off from we newcomers.
So you weren't taken under somebody's wing when you first came into the squadron?
No.
Can you tell me when your first experience of combat came?
Well, from Coldershall, which was really a reserve airfield for 11 Group and the fighting over the south of England, Coldershall. And I think Stuffy Dowding realised that the squadron had been so knocked about that we shouldn't really be at Coldershall. So we went farther north to Curtin Lindsay to re-equip and retrain, because there were only four or five of the original pilots left. And it wasn't until the following year, at the beginning of 1941, that I, with a man called Dundas, Hugh Dundas, intercepted a Dornier 17 over the North Sea in January of 1941. That's the first time I fired my guns in anger.
Can you describe that incident in detail, as far as you recollect it?
I recollect that it was we were scrambled from the base, and we had, even in those days, 1941, a long time ago now, we had some very good control in, and we were sent right out over the North Sea, and eventually we saw this Dornier about 5,000 or 6,000 feet below us, and we went in to attack it, Dundas first and me second, with our 8 machine guns. And when I broke away, Dundas fired off all his ammunition on a long astern attack, and so did I. And it was smoking slightly from one engine, and we claimed it as a damage. And later we heard from the intelligence it had crash-landed in Holland. So we were given a probably destroyed.
What were you firing?
Spitfire 1.
What was the pattern of your duties at that time?
The pattern of our duties, really, was to do convoy patrols off the North Sea, do some night flying where we had a little more time and more better equipment, and prepare ourselves to move to the south, which we did in February of that year. We moved down to Tangmere, when the squadron had retrained and re-equipped itself and brought itself up to strength. And we moved down to Tangmere, expecting to take part in another defensive battle against the Luftwaffe.
With those patrols, there were patrols over the East Coast convoys, were there?
Yes.
Were the East Coast convoys that you were patrolling often attacked?
Usually at first light and last light. Usually when we were going to them or coming back from them.
By what?
88s as a rule. Night fighters.
And how often were you in combat over the East Coast
convoys? Only just that once.
So it was very difficult to intercept?
It was difficult to intercept, but so many other people sort of... as I say, got into brief encounters at last light, just as they were withdrawing. And of course, the Spitfire, really a single seater, wasn't a night fighter. Wasn't equipped as a night fighter.
Did the escort vessels with the convoys ever fire on the RAF?
Yes, fired at everybody.
Were you fired on yourself?
Yes, but we always kept out of range. So we knew the range of their guns was, what, a mile and a half, so we flew at 2 miles around them.
Was there much excuse for that firing on their own side?
Well, they were very apprehensive. They couldn't recognise anything, and they were the same in Normandy. The Navy just fired at everything. In fact, that in Normandy, Cunningham had to see his opposite number and said that he was going to withdraw all air cover over the fleet unless they stop firing at us.
When you went down to Tangmere, can you describe the situation you found it there?
Yes, it was vastly different from the peace and quiet of Lincolnshire. Tangmere was very much in the front line, as it were. sirens were, as we got out of our airplane, sirens were sounding and squadrons were landing and that sort of thing. And there was an air of an operational air about the place, which had been bombed the day before, and the mess, the sergeant's mess was down, and the NAFI had been bombed and so on. So you were suddenly put back in the front line, as it were.
What kind of duties were you doing there? Can you tell me in more detail?
Well, yes, I can tell you, yes, I can. And we, as I said, we went down expecting to renew the Battle of Britain. And so when the Luftwaffe didn't come over again in the spring of 1941, then Fighter Command, who was at Sholto Douglas at the head then, started to send us out, reaching out, he called his philosophy, reaching out over the channel. In wing strength, with Douglas Bader leading the north, we're leading the Tangmere wing, and Sale Milan leading the Biggin wing, and various other famous people, Tuck and Deer and so on, and to try and entice the German Air Force to, or the German fighter force to come up. But they took little notice of us because we weren't doing much damage at 30,000 feet. When we flew over the Pas-de-Calais. So we started to escort a few bombers to bomb them. Those were called circus operations in the spring and summer of 1941, in the spring and early summer of 1941, and that succeeded in bringing them up to battle.
Why circus operations?
That was the code name, circus. Flying circus of the First War, I suppose.
Can you describe any dogfights that you were in doing that kind of work that stick in your mind?
Yes, I can. Because when we escorted the bombers, the Luftwaffe sort of responded in some strength, especially before they were drawn off to the Russian front, which, as I remember, was in July of 1941. So before that, there were some quite stern fights, and we lost quite a few people from the squadron, quite a few experienced people. Dundas, for example, was shot down. He wasn't killed. He managed to escape, but several Battle of Britain pilots were shot down, some killed, some prisoners. Bader was shot down and a prisoner of war. And it was quite a busy time, really. And for me, and for many pilots, a more dangerous type of flying than the Battle of Britain, because you've got the channel to cross two ways. And you were over enemy territory, you know, with most of your fighting.
Did you have any special equipment in case you came down in the sea at that time?
We had the dinghies had just been introduced. No, we didn't have the dinghies then, no. We just had the May West. I think the dinghies came in about a year later.
Did you feel confident about the arrangements that were made to get you out of the channel at that time?
I think We so regarded our Spitfire, we regarded it so superior to the opposition, that we didn't really think seriously of coming down. I certainly didn't. I was very, very confident that I wasn't going to be shot down, either over France or over the Channel.
With hindsight, do you think that confidence was justified in the Spitfire over what the Germans had?
I think we've got the morale was high. And people were generally shot down because they didn't keep a sufficient lookout, or they remained firing at somebody too long and allowed somebody else to get on their tails and so on and so forth. And I was a chap who was always content to shoot one down and come home and not bother to get the second one, if you understand me. He who fights and runs away.
And so those tactics proved to be justified?
I think so, yes.
Did you have any foreigners in your squadron?
Well, we were the South Yorkshire Squadron, and then I was a replacement, as I say, in 1940, and so were several other Englishmen. And it was not until about the spring, summer of 1941 that we began to get the odd Canadian. And then the odd Pole and Norwegian people who'd come over here, but had to be trained here, of course, because they could join us. So no non-English until about mid-41.
Did you find much difference between the foreigners as far as flying technique and attitude was concerned to the Englishman?
Don't think so. Later on, when I commanded my own squadron, it was comprised of all the nationalities, Poles and Czechs, Norwegians and Canadians, Australians, Rhodesians, South Africans and so on, and they all flew very well, all spoke the same language. I would have backed them against any English squadron.
Was the air war against the Luftwaffe fought in what you might call a gentlemanly way, or was it a vicious battle, would you say?
I think there was a certain amount of chivalry, a spillover from the First War, if you like, where when von Richthofen was shot down, the Royal Flying Corps flew over and dropped a wreath, regretting the death of somebody they call the most worthy enemy. And people were taken to the mess and entertained when they were shot down. And as Baader was in 1941, when he was taken down, because Galland, who was commanding on the other side, took Baader to the mess, wined and dined him, and that sort of thing. And you wouldn't get that in the army, I don't think, or the navy. And also, at that time, when Baader was shot down, the Luftwaffe said, if Baader wants a set of legs, his has been damaged, and we will guarantee safe conduct for a Red Cross airplane to come and bring a set of legs to Saint-Omer. So that was rather a nice thought, I thought. It was, yes, that is the answer to your question. And I never saw a German pilot shoot at an RAF pilot in his parachute. Never, ever. I had stories that this was so. I had stories that we had done to the same to the Germans, but I never saw it myself.
What was Douglas Baader like? You must have known him well.
Yes, he was an excellent leader. He was a good leader. He had time to teach young people, and he had the ability to impart his knowledge to young people and so on. And the morale in the Tangmere Wing was very high. In fact, Leddy Lucas in his book calls it the Tangmere Wing of all the talents, which I think is rather nice, although I was a member of it. The Tangmere Wing of all the talents.
What was the attitude in fighter command towards Dowding?
We regarded Dowding as remember, I was only a young pilot, but I'm now talking in hindsight, and what I have heard from Baader and people who met him and talked to him and that sort of thing, he was very much the father figure. And although he wasn't an operational man who flew the airplanes and so on and stuff, he's very much the father figure who would look after his pilots as much as possible and get for them what he possibly could, and admired because he'd done so much in building up the radar and so on.
Did you ever meet him personally on a visit to a squadron?
No, I didn't meet him until after the war.
Can we get back to the narrative of your own story with the operations of France? Do you know how many successes you had in that period?
I was awarded the DFC in August of the late August of 1941, when I think the citation said he has destroyed 4.5 enemy aircraft.
What did you think about the RAF procedure for confirmations of kills? Was it a valid one, a legitimate set of criteria?
Well, the set of criteria, as I remember, was that the chap had to bail out, or the aircraft catch on fire, or plunge into the ground for it to be counted as a confirmed victory. But if you were a little over-enthusiastic and there was a little fire and you claim a destroyed, then I think the mistake, probably the weakness, is that it ought to have been collaborated either by somebody else or a cine film. And of course in those days we didn't have cine films, there were very few about. And a pilot could come back and say, I have destroyed this airplane because I saw it crash on the ground. and with no collaboration or confirmation from anybody else. So if he was overclaiming or shooting a lion, that was the weakness of it.
What was the attitude of the British public towards fighter pilots? Were you lionized?
Yes, to some extent. We were the defenders of the people. We were, if you go back into your classics, we were the people who sallied to the city wall when it was under attack and poured out to repel the defender, Homer or whatever it is, and so on and so forth. We were the defenders of the people and had more adulation, if you like, that sort of thing, than the bomber command, which was rather dirty work anyway, wasn't it?
So how did the lionizing manifest itself in specific terms?
I think we were entertained very well when we were out and so on and so forth. We had a lot of invitations to country houses and parties and that sort of thing.
How did your work develop after this period over France? How did your own career develop?
After France, we remained at Tangmere until almost the end of, or October, what we call the end of the season, when the autumn's skies got clouded and the weather started to close in. And in October of 1941, we went back to Curtin Lindsay. And then we got on with our convoy patrols and our night flying and so on and so forth. And in the spring of 1942, we came back to Tangmere for the spring fighting and that sort of thing. At about that time, I was promoted and posted up, this is the middle of 1942, to Norfolk to take over 610 Squadron.
So you were then squadron leader?
Squadron leader. What was 610 was the County of Chester Squadron.
What was it equipped with?
Spitfire 5s.
How did the Spitfire 5 compare with the earlier marks of Spitfire?
Oh, it was, I think it was more powerful, it was faster, and best of all, it had two cannon in it. It had a good heavy armament on it.
Had that been a serious lack before, the armament?
The armament, the 8 machine guns with which we fought in the Battle of Britain were really a legacy of World War I, and they were not heavy enough really to destroy the German bombers. They were a little machine gun. They weren't really a World War II armament, and the Germans were well ahead of us and that sort of thing.
When you went into the attack, which particular part of the aircraft body would you aim at, personally?
Most of my fights were against fighters, and that's the thing. And I tried to come down on the... I don't see it here. I tried to come down on the fighter, so, say, about 10 degrees off, so I could get a shot into the cockpit there. Almost invariably you've got into the line of stern position where you were firing straight up his backside, but I preferred that slight angle off position there so you could get a shot into the cockpit or into his engine.
So you'd come in from behind, slightly to the side?
Slightly to the side, about like that. That was the idea, my ideal attacking position there.
So above, behind, and coming in from
and
the side.
Yes, 15 to 20 degrees off.
With your wings slightly tilted into
yes.
The victim.
Yes.